Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Since January of last year, Congress has been quiet while the executive branch has been involved in a blizzard of activity. In normal times, much of that activity would have been the result of congressional approval or would have been stopped by congressional action, but not under Trump. Under this administration, the Article I branch of government has willingly ceded power to the Article II branch. Recently, Donald Trump has been taking legally questionable actions against Venezuela, from blowing up boats on the high seas without a shred of evidence that they are drug runners, as was alleged, nary a peep from Capitol Hill. Then a military operation extracted the president of that country and his wife, transported them to the United States, and jailed them. It's an action that Congress would normally have been notified about in advance. That was not the case in this instance, because these are not normal times. So what is Congress doing? And what moves are being made to avert yet another government shutdown looming at the end of this month? For answers, we turn to three Washington reporters. Reuben Jones is the D.C. reporter for Spectrum News, covering North Carolina and national politics. His colleague Taylor Papalars is also with us. He's a national reporter for Spectrum. And we welcome Krista Dutton. She's a reporter and Allbritton Journalism Institute fellow, covering North Carolina for Notice, which is news of the United States. Krista, thank you for being here. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
And welcome to Reuben and to Taylor as well, but you're old timers, so I don't have to be nice to you. But I'm going to start with the two of you. We were talking about Congress. The Republican-controlled Congress has effectively rolled over and played dead on a lot of issues this year. And yesterday, the Trump administration said it cannot comply with a federal judge's order to provide dozens of deported Venezuelan migrants the opportunity to challenge their removals in an American court, because to do so would risk material damage to U.S. foreign policy interests in Venezuela. I think those are Marco Rubio's words. So they have yet again refused a court order. They are refusing to comply with a court order for an operation that was unauthorized by Congress. Congress wasn't consulted, which is a violation of the 1973 War Powers Resolution. Trump is shutting out or ignoring the two other co-equal branches of government, and these are authoritarian moves. So how is this being viewed or talked about in the halls of Congress behind the scenes, Reuben?
Well, in terms of how the president went about going into Venezuela, Republicans, for the most part, have been pretty supportive. Democrats have obviously raised significant concerns, including, as you mentioned, bypassing not just Congress, but bypassing congressional leadership. And that is a big concern. And so we did see, though, war powers vote in the Senate, where a number of Republicans did cross party lines to support that. President Trump spoke out adamantly against them, calling them out by name. But it's not clear that that's going to go forward. Where we've also and perhaps seen more criticism from Republicans is not over Venezuela, but over Greenland. And the president saying that the U.S. should own Greenland. Senator Tom Tillis spoke out very much against that. And we're going to see a bipartisan congressional delegation go to Denmark, which owns Greenland now, this weekend.
Yeah, there is a move, Taylor, among several senators, including Jean Shaheen, I think, from New Hampshire. She's the one that's spearheading this. They're trying to put in some sort of an act that would prevent any military incursion into Greenland. Is that accurate?
That is. Jean Shaheen, she's a Democrat from New Hampshire. She's the top Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. She's very respected. She's been in political office for decades, and she's somebody who is very plugged into the foreign policy space. But to your broader point, that, you know, we're a year into the president's second term, and this Greenland is kind of one of the first areas where a bipartisan group of lawmakers is standing up and saying, whoa, 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 can we press the brakes a bit, and can we talk about what's being pursued, whether you need to come through us for any type of authorization, and all of that. So I think it's a good example of how much the Republican-controlled Congress has said to President Trump, we trust you and we're not going to get in your way, because the president, his Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and Vice President J.D. Vance, and I should point out, Rubio and Vance are both former senators, they've basically signaled to Congress that you need to let us make these decisions and we're going to move fast, we're going to kind of quote-unquote break things, and then we'll talk to you later about it. The Venezuela strikes were so striking, and the Maduro operation was so striking. The top lawmakers on the intelligence committees were not even briefed ahead of time, and it took several days for them to get information. The public almost knew as much as they did. So this is nothing new over President Trump's second term. What's interesting is to see if he continues to kind of push the boundaries, will some of these lawmakers say, well, we think you crossed the line, but so far that line has continued to shift.
If you go into Greenland militarily, I suppose you could negotiate a deal with Denmark, which owns and controls Greenland, to buy it or to rent it or to do something. You could make some sort of an arrangement. But if you send troops into Greenland, then you're essentially ending NATO. Krista, would that not require congressional approval? We're ending NATO, for God's sake.
It would, Mike, and it'll be interesting to see whether Congress is, that's something that Congress wants to stand up and hold the president account to. I'll let Ruben or Taylor say more about kind of where they hear conversations on the Hill going in that regard.
Well, I'll just say, Mike, that Tillis and Shaheen are both co-chairs of the Senate NATO Advisory Group. And Tillis has been doing that for a number of years. I can tell you, I was over in NATO last year, and I was speaking with their head of communications about Tillis, given that Tillis is getting ready to retire. But he is very well known at NATO. His name is known. And he is very concerned about any talk that would not only take over Greenland, but would dampen the relations that the U.S. has with NATO.
If I could just build on what Ruben was saying, just on NATO, what's been striking over the last year, I've been based at the White House, I'm here right now, and the president has been so hot and cold on NATO. Various NATO country leaders and the Secretary General of NATO have visited the White House multiple times. And at times, the president has said, our relationship with NATO is better than ever. He's convinced other countries to contribute more financially. And that's been a victory that the NATO Secretary General has acknowledged. But then on the flip of a dime, the president will talk about Greenland, or he'll talk about another country, and he'll say, I'm really frustrated with NATO, and I wish that they would get behind me. So it's a reminder of like the personal relationships the president has with these countries and how hot and cold he can be with them.
Yeah, a lot of this could be bluster. A lot of this could be negotiation points that he wants to make out front and scare them into agreeing with him on a lot of things. But if you were to go into Greenland militarily and try to take it over, the NATO countries are pledged to react to something like that militarily, which would put us in a sticky place. But I heard somebody the other day say, you know, they don't have to fire a shot. They hold a lot of U.S. debt. They could just dump their bonds, and that would put us in a very bad position economically. Is that being floated around the halls of Congress?
It's a good question. I haven't heard it floated, but it's a good point.
Okay. We have witnessed the tactics being used by ICE and Border Patrol agents in American cities, including our own. We've witnessed the chaos those tactics cause. Those tactics include the power to legally arrest someone without a warrant if they have a reason to believe someone is removable and likely to flee. But constitutional protections against the use of force and the guarantee of due process technically remain. In Minneapolis, an American citizen, of course, was shot and killed. And in the aftermath, federal officials have doubled down on those tactics and increased the number of agents flooding into Minneapolis, twice the number, I think, of the police force in both Minneapolis and St. Paul. Again, Krista, anyone in Congress concerned that we may be heading down a well-trodden path that does not turn out well?
Mm-hmm. You're definitely seeing some concern, especially among Democrats in Congress, at the extremes and the lengths that Border Patrol agents and ICE are willing to go to carry out these immigration enforcement operations. I mean, Charlotte even saw its own operation last fall. More than 400 people were arrested there when Border Patrol agents were sent to carry out its an operation there. And that operation may come back, the Mecklenburg county officials have said that it hasn't been confirmed that they may come back, but that it's possible. So yeah, it's something to watch to see whether congressional leaders will begin to push back against these tactics that we're seeing.
They've sent officers to Chicago. I think they've sent them to LA. I think San Francisco, certainly Portland, obviously Charlotte and other places in North Carolina. But the real focus and the real clampdown seems to be in Minnesota. Why?
That's right. Minnesota has been in the news a lot lately. In December, we saw this huge fraud scandal statewide about its social welfare programs. And that just really turned its attention, especially to its immigrant community, as most people that were charged with these fraud allegations were of Somali descent. So there's been this huge focus on immigration there. And so when thousands of agents went to the state last week, of course, they ended up killing a woman who was in her car. And this has set off just absolute chaos in the city. Protesters are showing up to protest against ICE. The local officials there have been quite brazen in their response to the administration. The mayor of Minneapolis especially has made lots of headlines telling ICE to get the F out of the city. He's been very bold about that. So yeah, Minnesota is just the latest state to see this influx of ICE agents there and see a pretty strong local response to that.
Minnesota has two Democratic U.S. senators. Their House delegation is evenly split among Democrats and Republicans. What have those members of Congress been saying behind the scenes or in public?
Senator Amy Klobuchar has been quite outspoken about DHS trying to work with local officials there to carry out an investigation about this killing. But she has also wanted ICE to really tone down its operations to do things more lawfully and to tone down the temperature in the city. Many members of that delegation have been quite outspoken about that.
Clearly falling on deaf ears. There are those, Taylor, who insist that with some justification that the actions being perpetrated by the Trump administration are taking us to a place that we have never been before. And the United States of today is not the United States of even last year. And Congress really hasn't done much about this until this week. PBS reports that Democrats and certain Republicans, their words, on the Hill are vowing an assertive response to the shooting in Minneapolis. Everything from a full investigation into the shooting to policy changes over law enforcement's raids to the defunding of ICE operations, even the impeachment of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. Is any of that getting any traction?
It's getting traction in the sense of, you know, members will post statements about it or pledges to pursue things that will go viral, or they'll do interviews, as Krista was alluding to, that will get attention. But Republicans still control both the House and Senate, and their leadership has indicated they do not want to ruffle feathers with President Trump in circumstances like this. I think the Minneapolis ICE shooting has been really striking because the president has made clear over the last year he is bucking norms in the sense of sending federal agents into cities and states where the local and state leadership don't want it. There's a difference if a governor or a mayor calls up the White House and says, we need the National Guard, we need ICE to come in, we're dealing with an issue. And there have been a couple, you know, red-leaning states where they have welcomed them in. I think of Louisiana, I think of Tennessee. But then these blue-leaning states have been so against it. And that has prompted court battles, that has prompted Democratic lawmakers to speak out. But because Republicans still control Congress, it's difficult to get votes brought to the floor related to that. So I think what's striking is as more information comes out and as more scrutiny is applied to both this Minneapolis shooting and other potential incidents, it'll be interesting to see if there's any bipartisan pressure there. But so far, for the most part, Republican lawmakers have been okay and defer to Democrats or defer to the president.
We witnessed the deployment of National Guard troops during the Civil Rights Movement. We witnessed it during Kent State, during the Vietnam War movement, but nothing like this. This is a really interesting optic look. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more. We'll talk more about that and also what's on the agenda for 2026 on Capitol Hill. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcltregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about goings on Capitol Hill and the 2026 agenda in that part of Washington with Reuben Jones, Washington reporter on North Carolina and national politics for Spectrum News. Taylor Popolars is a national political reporter also with Spectrum News. And Krista Dutton is a reporter for Notice. Connecticut Democratic Senator Chris Murphy is attempting to put together a congressional coalition to pass new restrictions on the Department of Homeland Security. He wants that coalition to consider requiring agents to have a warrant in order to make arrests, prohibiting the wearing of masks, and forcing Border Patrol to stay at the border. He wants to make this a condition of funding for the Department of Homeland Security, Reuben, and some on the Hill believe this could be the next issue that would lead to a government shutdown. In other words, don't pass those requirements and we will shut it down again. What, if anything, are you hearing about that?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly been a growing momentum from the Democratic perspective of we want to hold up DHS funding because of what we're seeing happening with ICE. And so that will continue to play out. Remember, Democrats held up the shutdown, created the shutdown last time because they were worried about cuts to health care, and Republicans didn't cooperate with them on that. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I was going to pick up off one point you mentioned before the break, Mike, which is, are we seeing any criticism from ICE with Republicans? One person I'll mention who is giving criticism is not within the halls of Congress, but almost sometimes has more power than some members, and that's Joe Rogan, who said, I think yesterday or today, that are we really going to be the Gestapo when referring to what he's seeing with these ICE agents and wearing the masks that you refer to? You know, you'll hear this name a lot during the hour is Tom Tillis, because he is the one senator who has raised questions about what happened with Border Patrol in Charlotte. He asked the Department of Homeland Security for a breakdown of numbers of the arrests, the hundreds of arrests we saw in North Carolina. How many of those people actually had violent criminal records? As in Chicago, it was very low. As of last check, when I checked with Tillis's office, he's not gotten those numbers yet. But that's something to keep a close eye on.
Joe Rogan has brought the bro culture into the Trump fold. And when Joe Rogan uses a term like Gestapo in referring to ICE agents on the street, he gets your attention, because other people are reluctant to make comparisons to what was happening in Nazi Germany prior to Hitler's rise or during Hitler's rise. But all of this looks very similar. What do you think the impact of Joe Rogan coming out and saying that will be, not just on individuals who listen to him and who support Donald Trump, but on members of Congress? Taylor.
Well, what I could tell you two things to build off of Reuben's great points. One, this White House and this administration are comprised of incredibly online people who take the words of somebody like a powerful podcaster like Joe Rogan very, very seriously. What's been striking is to see how the administration has been packaging its ICE and deportation related content online. It's often these kind of Hollywood-esque vertical videos that have, you know, pop music and really dramatic images, and the administration is cheering that on. But that's exactly what Joe Rogan is commenting about, and they pay attention to that. I think also, just to go back to the policy side of it, when we were talking about Chris Murphy, the senator from Connecticut, he is on the Appropriations Committee. He's the top Democrat that oversees funding for DHS. So even though he is in the minority, he does have a little bit of elevation where he needs to be taken seriously for that. Another senator who is the head of the Appropriations Committee is Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins, who is one of the most moderate Republicans and has at times expressed, kind of like with Senator Tillis, has expressed some concern about the Trump administration's steps they've been taking, how they've approached deportation. So I don't necessarily think there's going to be a government shutdown over this at the end of the month, but I do think over time, if this continues in city after city, lawmakers like that could speak up, coupled with these big pop culture figures like Joe Rogan speaking out.
So you have Joe Rogan, who is an influencer, and there are other influencers in that same camp who are beginning to take notice of tactics that appear to be similar to what has happened in fascist regimes. And they're saying it out loud, and they have a tremendous number of followers. And then we have the information that was released, I think just yesterday, that young people, Gen Z or Gen X, I can't remember which, are swinging wildly toward Democrats in double digits, and this is a midterm election year, Krista. Is this all coming together? Is this a perfect storm that might catch the attention of members of Congress?
That's a good question, Mike. I think definitely when we look at things like affordability is kind of the big buzzword going on right now, or frustration with federal immigration officers. All these issues are definitely going to culminate into things that voters, especially young voters, really care about going into the midterm elections. You know, we have both Senate candidates in North Carolina talking a lot about rising prices, and they're also talking a lot about crime, especially after last year when we saw the young Ukrainian woman killed on public transit in Charlotte. That has been kind of this major example that especially Senate candidate Michael Whatley, the former RNC chair who's running for Senator Tillis' seat, has really talked about, and he's talked about crime and immigration a lot. So I think you can expect a lot of candidates in these North Carolina races to talk a lot about, one, rising prices, and especially try to appeal to these young voters who are looking at the miserable job market and then also rising costs and wondering how they're supposed to kind of get their life underway.
Meanwhile, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, a Democratic senator, says that we have a dysfunctional Congress, many members of which are betraying their oath to the Constitution, these are his words, as they fail to oppose the overreach of the Trump administration and some of the things that they have been engaged in, which border on or are in fact illegal. Booker is calling on people, us, to put pressure on Congress to do their job. He says, quote, "The people have more power than the people in power." Well, that's a campaign slogan. Are members of Congress beginning to feel this? I don't care which one of you answers that question, but that's a pretty accurate statement, and it is an election year.
Well, I remember going to Cory Booker when he did his, what was it? He was sitting on the step. Taylor can help me out. He was sitting on the steps of Congress.
Yeah, he was doing a sit out, you know, yeah. Like a, right. Yeah, a protest.
And I stopped by there and for a few minutes, and he was saying a similar thing. The power of the people is what matters. And that's right to an extent. And we've seen it play out in these No Kings rallies. We've seen it play out when Republican lawmakers try and hold town halls and they get lots of people turning out and they get people who are upset. But at the end of the day, it's Republicans who are in control of Congress, and Republicans can stop some of the things that the president is doing if they choose to do it. So, you know, it will fall to the midterm elections in terms of the power of the people. That will be the deciding decision here. But, you know, it's a point that the senator makes.
And so, Mike, to build on your point about that being a campaign slogan, the Democrats were talking about Cory Booker from New Jersey, Chris Murphy from Connecticut. I think of Mark Kelly from Arizona, Alyssa Slotkin from Michigan. These are the most vocal critics of the administration. All of them are potential presidential candidates in 2028. And they're using this time in the minority where they don't have a lot of say to drive up their fundraising, drive up their notoriety, get a lot of attention, and try to capitalize on what is a very dysfunctional Congress. The other thing I'll point out about the dysfunction, and we see this every midterm election year, but a ton of members, both in the House and Senate, are choosing to retire or run for offices outside of Congress because they're so frustrated with the dysfunction and the fact that the Trump administration has taken control of the steering wheel in so many ways. So there are a lot of factors kind of looping into that, but so much of it, whether people like it or not, comes back to politics.
And that includes Republicans who are tired of it and retiring. And it just strikes me as curious. If you're a Republican and you're in Congress, take control of the reins. What's wrong with you? Let's talk about what might be on the congressional agenda for 2026. Venezuela and ICE activities at home, along with the talk of invading Greenland, and effectively ending NATO, along with potential action now in Iran, has pushed the Epstein files out of the headlines. Has it pushed those files out of the minds of Congress, Ruben? Where does that stand?
It hasn't pushed their minds out of it. It's also not pushed the documents to be released. I mean, the number of documents that the DOJ has released is incredibly small. There are thousands of documents that still remain out there, and that is a concern not only of Democrats, but Republicans who had been pushing for the release of these documents, including Thomas Massie, Kentucky congressman. So that is very much, I think, going to still be very prevalent, considering that's also a very big issue for the MAGA base, the MAGA voters who really wanted the president to do that. And so it was front and center this week with former President Bill Clinton getting subpoenaed to appear before Congress. He decided not to. But at the end of the day, these documents are going to have to be released, or you're going to see, I think, Congress take some action.
Is this flurry of activity, this surge of ICE to Minnesota, the attack, the extraction of the president of Venezuela, the threats to Iran if they don't, if they start shooting protesters, the idea of taking over Greenland, Krista, is this to take people's eye off the Epstein ball, so to speak?
Some people might would say that. I think I would also, to go off Ruben's point, say that it's definitely been sidelined in some of these other major headlines, but I don't think it's something that Republicans and Democrats are going to forget about. I mean, just yesterday, Representatives Ro Khanna and Thomas Massie basically asked the Justice Department to appoint the special master to oversee the handling of the Epstein files because of their frustration with the number of redactions in them and the department's delay and in releasing all of them. So I think it's definitely still a simmering frustration, but I think you're right. A lot of other headlines have dominated their recent weeks.
And when it comes to the Epstein files, Ruben, again, the Trump administration is in violation of the law, a law just passed by Congress mandating that they turn over primarily unredacted files, all of them concerning Epstein. I think they've released 1% of the files. Many of them have been heavily redacted, and those redactions have not been explained, as is mandated in that law. What's Congress doing? What can they do in the face of a recalcitrant administration?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're seeing, as Krista points out, that some of the steps that they've taken in the initial phase, I mean, look, it is a lot of documents to release. That is a clear fact. But I mean, I think that the next step, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but I would think that it would have to fall to the courts if they were not getting, if DOJ was not following through on this legislation, I believe it would have to go to the courts.
But they tend to ignore court orders in the Trump administration. Okay.
No we'll comment. See what, yeah, yeah.
We'll see what happens. Okay. Speaking of Epstein, former president, as somebody just mentioned, former President Bill Clinton was scheduled to testify yesterday. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is scheduled to testify today behind closed doors with James Comey as the chairman of that committee. Both have refused to do so. And in a joint letter to the committee chair, they wrote, quote, "Every person has to decide when they have seen or heard enough and are ready to fight for this country, its principles, and its people, no matter the consequences. For us, now is that time." And they called on the DOJ to release the Epstein files. Bill Clinton has said for weeks, months, that he has nothing to hide. Turn out the files. So Comer, the consequence for being held in contempt of Congress, which is something that Comer is threatening, carries a $100,000 fine and 12 months in prison. If you recall, several prominent Republicans, Taylor, refused to testify before the January 6th committee, including Donald Trump, Mark Meadows, Steve Bannon, Kevin McCarthy, and Jim Jordan, among others. And that committee chose either not to file contempt charges or did so. And then the Merrick Garland Department of Justice chose not to prosecute. I think only Steve Bannon and Peter Navarro served 4 months in prisons as a result of being held in contempt. With that as prologue, what is likely to happen here?
I think it is safe to say it would be shocking if former President Clinton and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton were actually, you know, carried through to court on contempt charges. I think they would face similar journeys as we saw for those for those lawmakers that you mentioned. I was assigned to cover Ohio's delegation when Congressman Jim Jordan was dealing with all of that, and he remains chair of the Judiciary Committee to this very day, and it really did not impact him in any way. I think what's striking about the Clintons' letter that they released is that they're choosing now to say this is a time that we have to stand up. There are legitimate questions that former President Clinton can answer, and that the public is wondering about his interactions with Jeffrey Epstein, the relationship that they had, the fact that Epstein had this orbit of very powerful people in both parties who interacted with him regularly. What's also happening at the same time is the Trump administration has chosen to selectively release much more information and photos related to Clinton than the current president himself, than other Republicans who are connected to this orbit. So it's very political in that sense. But to Ruben's point, the courts could get involved. But what these two congressmen, Thomas Massie from Kentucky and Ro Khanna, a Democrat from California, have said, if these documents don't continue to get released, they will seek to hold in contempt of Congress the attorney general, the FBI director. I think that's where we could see some more significant action rather than a former president and former first lady secretary of state getting sent to court or prison.
And to be clear, President Clinton is not being accused of any wrongdoing. And he, as I said, repeatedly said he has nothing to hide. He's encouraged the files to be released. He did that. He did so again in this letter. But apparently the Clintons are making what they consider to be an important statement about what's happening in the country. That letter goes on, bringing the Republicans' cruel agenda to a standstill while you work harder to pass a contempt charge against us than you have done on your investigation this past year, would be our contribution to fighting the madness. Those words are theirs. Is this something that they're doing on their own, or is this part of an emerging Democratic strategy to fight against the Trump regime, Krista?
Taylor was on a roll there, so I'll let him keep going with that.
Okay,
one.
Taylor, go ahead.
I think that to this day, even though the prospects of or the results of the midterm elections right now are looking like it'll probably swing in Democrats' favor in some sense, as political history shows, the party in power often performs less well in the midterms. Democrats to this day are still trying to figure out their approach to Trump 2.0 and how they want to quote unquote resist, where they want to take legal battles, where they want to take legislative battles. And I think what's interesting is the Clintons remain a very powerful force in the party, but they also have no current power beyond their platforms and the fact of the previous positions that they're holding. So I think Epstein, the Democrats saw success in pushing through the Epstein files. They also benefited from a handful of Republicans, Thomas Massie, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who latched onto the cause with them and helped deliver the votes necessary to make it happen. So I think it's hard to know if this will be kind of the resistance strategy heading into November, but Democrats are definitely trying out everything because there is a flood of information coming out from this administration.
I have less than a minute left, Ruben, in this segment, and I'm curious about it. We went through the longest government shutdown in history in the fall, and now another one is on the horizon. Remind us why.
Because Congress fails to do its job in terms of passing a permanent budget. And so they push it off, they push it off, they push it off. It's not anything new. And now we're seeing it play out again. They need to pass appropriate, what are known as appropriations bills. And one of the appropriations bills, as we referred to, is for the Department of Homeland Security. And if Democrats want to, they could hold things up and say, no, we're not giving funding to DHS, to ICE, because of what we've seen play out in the country.
When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about that and how this shutdown may or may not be averted, plus some other things going on in Congress behind the scene. They're not just not doing anything. They are doing some things. They're just not getting all the press because it's being eclipsed by what's coming out of the White House. Ruben Jones is here, and Taylor Popolars from Spectrum News, and Krista Dutton from Notice. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. Their small classes offer a supportive learning environment where middle schoolers can develop curiosity and essential skills like critical thinking, collaboration, and problem solving. Details at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins, and we're getting our congressional update today from Ruben Jones, Washington reporter for Spectrum News, and Taylor Popolars, also a national political reporter for Spectrum. And Krista Dutton is with us. She's a reporter for Notice, News of the United States. We were talking about the potential of another government shutdown at the end of this month. The main issue that drove the shutdown in the fall was the demand, as we've mentioned, by Democrats, that subsidies for those with health insurance through the Affordable Care Act be extended. That did not happen. And once Congress came back, the Senate fell short of passing a number of different proposals to address health care costs. But this month, the House successfully passed a Democratic-led discharge petition to force a vote on extending those subsidies. Krista, the result was the passage of a bill extending them for 3 years on a 230-196 vote. Now it's in the Senate's hands. So how do things look in that body for that issue?
Mm-hmm. There's a bipartisan group of senators working together to, like you said, revive these lapsed ACA subsidies. There's been some debate and kind of quibble over what to do about the Hyde Amendment, which prohibits federal funds to be used for abortions. So there's a lot of Republican infighting about what to do about that. The president last week, I believe, asked the senators to kind of be flexible about that, which raised a lot of eyebrows. And these ACA subsidies would have an enormous impact on North Carolina. About 10% of North Carolinians use these, and I think the governor's made it quite clear that he would like to see these revived.
In order to get that through the House, a number of Republicans had to break ranks and join Democrats. What are the dynamics in the Senate?
I think it remains to be seen, who decides to buck party leadership and try to hop on these bills. Perhaps Ruben has some more insights there that I don't have, but yeah, I think it's really up in the air to see who ends up bucking the leadership and joining them.
Ruben, you want to add to that?
Well, on the House side, we didn't see any North Carolina Republicans cross party lines to support Democrats on this extension. I think, again, the senator to watch here would be Tom Tillis. Obviously, he had a lot of concerns about the changes to Medicaid that the president's quote-unquote one big beautiful bill had. I would not expect Senator Budd to join on some of this, but we'll wait and see. I think it all depends on what negotiations are reached here. There's talk about, all right, maybe we won't extend it 3 years, we'll extend it 2 years. And so it really depends what kind of shape this takes.
Taylor?
I think what was interesting about the House vote, I think it was 17 or so Republicans who joined in voting for it, and a lot of them come from more competitive districts where they know this is going to be a political issue in November. In the Senate, and Kristen did a great job outlining it, but one of the leaders on the Republican side trying to reach this deal is a newer Republican senator named Bernie Moreno from Ohio, who is in no way a moderate Republican. He is very aligned to President Trump and the MAGA movement. So I think there, who knows if they'll actually succeed, but it's an acknowledgement from that wing of the party that they have to figure something out because millions of people are dealing with these higher healthcare costs. The last thing I'll say is President Trump went to Michigan yesterday to talk about the economy and affordability. He, weaved in and out of a bunch of other topics while he was there. But one thing he alluded to is he said, by the end of this week, I'm going to be announcing or unveiling my framework for a healthcare fix. He pledged to do this before the holidays and he pledged to meet with health insurance executives. None of that has happened yet. So we'll have to see if this actually is serious, but that we'll have to pair whatever he introduces with what the Senate is pursuing to see if there's a possible compromise there.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he promised that every week in the last Trump administration. There are things
That is
going
correct.
on with, there are things going on in Congress with smaller bills that most of us aren't paying any attention to. For instance, Florida Republican Ana Paulina Luna had a bill to force a vote on a bill to bar members of Congress and their immediate families from trading individual stocks. Don Bacon, Republican from Nebraska, was considering another to force a vote on a bipartisan bill to place harsher penalties on Russia amidst the war in Ukraine. Have either of those moves had any action taken on them? Ruben?
I'm not sure about Don Bacon's bill. I know that the stock trading bill has not gotten to the floor for a vote. I don't think her petition has near enough votes. I haven't checked it recently. Someone can correct me. So there's still ways to go on that. But it is something that we've seen cross-party support, Republican and Democrat support, putting a ban in place.
Anything else? Small bills, large bills trying to make their way through Congress that we should know about?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interesting bills in Congress, and a lot of them are bipartisan. They don't get near enough attention. The problem is a lot of them just haven't gotten votes. I mean, I could list you about a dozen that I think are interesting, but I think the focus right now is ACA subsidies, the healthcare subsidies. It's Venezuela, and it's a number of things that are coming directly from the White House, not so much directly from Congress.
Trump, everybody I think would agree with this on both sides of the aisle, is reshaping the world order. And he is reshaping the U.S. economy. And he is overturning, without regard to science, this may not be agreeable on both sides of the aisle, but he's overturning, without regard to science, healthcare guidelines that have stood the test of time. He's making enemies of people who have been traditional allies in this country. He's sidling up to our traditional enemies in many cases. He is supporting the protesters in Iran while taking a get-tough approach against protesters in this country. He is backing away from America First campaign promises like opening the Epstein files and working to lower inflation, although he says he has ended inflation, which is not true, and avoiding foreign conflicts. Instead, he extracted the leader of Venezuela in a military operation. He's threatening to take over Greenland one way or the other, his words, and is supposedly preparing a policy shift on Cuba. All of this is happening unilaterally in the executive branch, but congressional Republicans apparently are beginning to wake up. When Trump's DOJ announced a criminal investigation into Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis, who seems to be the squeaky wheel now that he's decided not to run anymore, he spoke up. He said he would block or oppose all of Donald Trump's Federal Reserve nominees, including the nominee for the upcoming Fed chair vacancy, until that investigation is fully resolved. Taylor, does Tillis have the power as a senator to successfully do that, and will he stick to his guns?
I think he's definitely sticking to his guns because, as you mentioned, he has nothing to lose now that he's leaving office and he doesn't have to worry about the political ramifications. This Jerome Powell story has been really striking because, arguably, even more than the foreign policy issues we've been discussing, it has gotten the most bipartisan pushback from members of the Senate and the House. And I think, for to put into perspective for people, it's not just retiring members. The top House Republican of the Financial Services Committee is an Arkansas congressman named French Hill, who votes through and through with the Trump administration. He released a statement saying this is a distraction, this is not going to help make things more affordable, and the president should really, you know, rein it back. So I think in that sense, Tillis's efforts could have momentum because most lawmakers like and respect Jerome Powell in both parties, and they're not looking to see the Federal Reserve get disrupted in this way at a time when the economy is in such, you know, in certain ways the economy is doing pretty well, in other areas it's quite shaky, and in an election year the last thing these lawmakers want is to see it disrupted and kind of thrown for a loop.
Well, most economic experts say that an independent Federal Reserve is the bedrock, not just of the U.S. economy, but of the world economy. It's always operated without political influence, and Donald Trump believes he should be in charge of everything, including money policy. Monetary experts say that when it comes to influencing monetary policy, that would be a disaster. So aside from Tom Tillis and Senator Lisa Murkowski, who says she backs Tillis, plus Louisiana Republican John Kennedy, who said that we need this probe like we need a hole in the head. How many other members of Congress, Krista, particularly Republicans, both recognize any political influence over the Fed as a threat and are willing to act on it?
Yeah, the situation with Jerome Powell has been so interesting to me because it's been one of these salient issues that Republicans have really decided to buck the president on and kind of have pause about. I'm trying to think of some other names besides the ones that you mentioned, and perhaps Ruby can count me out here. But yeah, I think, like we were just saying, there's a ton of respect for Jerome Powell, and there's a hesitancy to have the executive branch interfere with the Fed here. So it's definitely something that I've been surprised to see Republicans, not necessarily surprised, but it's been one of those things where you have seen Republicans take a spine about.
I think there's two quick points here. One is Senator Tillis, yes, it is noteworthy regarding the Fed chair vacancy. I found his comments, though, about the DOJ to be even more noteworthy because he called into question whether there is independence and credibility within the DOJ. And that is something Democrats have pushed against the president for more than a year because it was something they warned about during the elections that this would happen. And so for Tillis to say that, a member of not only the Budget Committee, but also the Judiciary Committee, I think that's extremely significant. The other point I think is important to note here is that yes, Senator Tillis has come after the Trump administrations on a number of occasions. This with the Fed, this with Greenland, the tax and spending bill known as the One Big Beautiful Bill. But what you always see and how he criticizes the Trump administration usually is he criticizes an advisor. He criticizes members of the administration. Where you don't see him come after the president is the president himself. He's very careful in how he words it. And I think that's important to note because he's very cautious when it comes to actually criticizing the president directly. Yes, he's done it on some occasions, but it's not as much as some of these big things.
Why, Ruben? He's not running for re-election. He has nothing to lose. Why would he not go after the, even if Donald Trump is not coming up with these ideas or he's not the final person arbitrating all of this, he is the guy, he's the point man. The buck stops there. So why not go after him?
Well, what have we seen with senators who go directly after the president? We saw Mitt Romney do it. He's no longer in the Senate. We saw Susan Collins sometimes do it. She got a nasty phone call from the president, reportedly. And so, go ahead.
But next January, he won't be in the Senate. Taylor, go ahead.
I think there is a political component to this, that Tillis's seat being opened up creates one of the most, if not the most, U.S. competitive U.S. Senate race in the country. That, and Tillis, I think, and Ruben could tell me, I don't know if you've talked with him about this or Krista recently, but Tillis would love to see Republicans stay in control of the Senate. And Michael Whatley winning that race against former Governor Roy Cooper is going to be crucial if Trump gets so upset with Tillis's personal comments that he says, I don't want, even want to pay attention to North Carolina, which the president does have a record of, you know, getting personally frustrated with things and then backing away. That could have an unintended political impact. I'm not saying that's the only reason, but I think that might be part of it, because Tillis knows how important that race is going to be for the future of the Senate.
But and the where president, there... yes, and the president yesterday, when he was asked about Tillis, he said, Tillis, oh yeah, that guy. I like Tillis. He's a good guy, but he's wrong on this. He's going to be out of the Senate soon.
But where the ice is breaking, if it is breaking, where the pushback is it beginning because the Congress is finally beginning to think, gee, we don't do anything. We've been minimized here. We are a co-equal branch of government. Or is it the midterms looming large and they're seeing what's happening with polling among voters? Or is it what they're seeing they believe now to be dangerous? Who would like Taylor, go ahead.
I think it could be a combination of all of those, more so the realization that they haven't accomplished much, tied with the fact that many of them are running for re-election and they may not have a whole lot to campaign on, you know. But in terms of, as Ruben mentioned earlier this hour, you know, when we've seen those No Kings protests where millions of people have turned out, when we've seen the protests in response to the ICE shooting, when we've seen, you know, frustrations over how certain foreign policy matters are handled, these lawmakers are hearing about it in their events when they visit their districts and their home states, and that does have a direct impact on their ability to run for re-election. So there's always a political tie to it. But I also think, you know, the Trump administration prides itself on flooding the zone. Multiple advisors have told me and others that, like, chaos is their fuel. And I think lawmakers are trying to figure out which issues amongst this, you know, wave of chaos they want to latch onto to say, this is where I draw a line in the sand. This is important to me.
One way Congress has been minimized is through their oversight responsibilities, and the Trump administration is constantly putting up roadblocks to prevent them from exercising that. In the last week, members of Congress were prevented from entering an ICE facility in, I think, Minnesota, because Kristi Noem changed the rules, saying that they needed to give 7 days notice. Is that kind of activity, Krista, starting to mute or encourage dissent among members of Congress toward the administration?
I think that's definitely another point of frustration that especially Democratic lawmakers are having against the administration. We've seen a few lawmakers want to go visit these ICE detention facilities and told that they can't. So I think that's definitely something to watch as another another point of contention for them among that.
Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth has said he is taking formal punitive action against Arizona Senator Mark Kelly. He issued a letter of censure to Kelly, calling his participation in the video with other members of Congress, including Melissa Slotkin, reminding servicemen and women that they don't have to follow unlawful orders. Reckless misconduct is what he called it. He called it seditious. The Pentagon has begun the process of reducing Kelly's rank, his cutting his retirement pay. Kelly is countersuing to stop all of that, and he's called these moves unlawful and unconstitutional. Is he, the senator, getting any significant or meaningful support from fellow senators on both sides of the aisle, Ruben?
Not from Republicans that I've seen. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but I've not seen that discussed too much.
Because Slotkin evidently is also now under investigation for the same thing. She's been asked to meet with investigators, I think from the Defense Department perhaps, and she's a former veteran as well. This seems to be a slap in the face to military people, and also because it's in the law. They didn't say anything that wasn't true. And these are members of Congress. Wouldn't this put a damper on what members of Congress can say?
There definitely is concern about a chilling effect, and it is an escalation by the Trump administration, and it is unprecedented to have the Defense Department, to have the Justice Department investigating sitting lawmakers over comments. People have to remember this is in the weeds, but these lawmakers are protected by a speech and debate clause. They can basically say what they want while they're in office if it has to do with, you know, their job as a lawmaker. This is also very political. And like I mentioned, I hate to come back to it all the time, but Mark Kelly and Alyssa Slotkin are potential presidential candidates. They are where they're benefiting from this is they are getting a lot of attention and they are fundraising a lot. What's unclear is if there will be bipartisan defense of them.
Taylor Papalardz is the national political reporter for Spectrum News. Reuben Jones is with us, Washington reporter on North Carolina and national politics, also for Spectrum, and Krista Dutton, reporter for Notice. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.